This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
Hey, it's my pleasure to welcome Jeff Mackey to the show. He is host of Breakout on Yahoo Finance and an original cast member of CNBC's Fast Money and author of Clash of the Financial Pundits, How the Media Influences Your Investment Decisions for Better or Worse. Jeff, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm the man doing well. Thanks for having me.
Well, good, good. Well, hey, it is great to have you. You just took a really interesting trip across the country. You saw some interesting stuff. Give us a little feedback on your trip.
Well, you know, I grew up in retail. My father worked at Target, and so we would go from Target to Target. And he taught me the best way to learn how a business is going and how people are doing is to not be the guy who yells at the person at the service desk, but rather ask them just how you doing, whether it's your waiter or business owner, someone you're sitting next to, and really just listen to the problems, hear them out. And what I heard out there, it's this economy is booming, and it's not in a bubble sense. It's not in a sense where the popular portrayal seems to be something along the lines of Mr. Burns or Snidely Whiplash preying on these poor 99% people. I think this is a much more broad-based type of economic recovery, and I think people are doing a little better than anyone wants to admit. I'm not sure why that is, but I was really struck by the nature of the country, the disconnect between what we're reading about and the popular press and sort of the sense of optimism being expressed by the way people are investing and behaving in the economy itself. And it was actually quite encouraging. I think it's a great time to be a consumer right now in particular.
Yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, technology has pushed down the cost of everything. Well, not everything, but at least consumer products in terms of electronic and tech products. With the tools we've got for this nearly frictionless global commerce system called the internet, I mean, price discovery, comparison shopping, reading reviews, getting better products, manufacturers making better products because they're listening to customer feedback. Yeah.
And that loop is incredible, you know, and they talk about it a lot in retail, and we just did ourselves, but it extends so far beyond just that retail model. It extends into, we went across country, I had exactly one hotel reservation, and that was at Disneyland because that's one of the few places on earth where you can't just walk in and figure out a way to go see it because it's genuinely is sold out. But I tell you what, using just a smartphone, I was able to book hotels at boutique hotels that people have gone ahead and taken the economic risk to go build themselves and start to find locations and expose my family to stuff that we otherwise wouldn't have seen as recently as 5-10 years ago simply because he couldn't find it. And so you both have price discovery where you're not going to get gouged, where you're not going to pay an arm and a leg, and also product discovery. And if you're baffled with how you use the internet and use this technology to your advantage, it's going to control the prices, not just in terms of electronics, but in your hotel room, in your flight, in your just in terms of the bang for the buck, you're getting what you pay for to a degree that we haven't seen in this really ever in history. And it's incredibly encouraging if you look at it from a big picture perspective.
I would agree with you completely, Jeff. It is an incredible time to be alive. And I'll give you a personal example. About maybe 5-6 years ago, I discovered Hotwire and I started using it. And I discovered all sorts of new hotels I would have never known about, I would have never picked. And by golly, I'm staying at hotels now for half the price I used to pay. And you know, you could call that the economy and the financial crisis, or you could call it technology, or you could call it a blend of all the above. And the interesting thing about it is all these new incredible business models we're seeing. When it comes to Hotwire, for example, hotels can have a risk-free way, and same with Priceline. I don't want to be, you know, non-agnostic. I'm not promoting the brand. I'm just saying conceptually it's an interesting technology because it allows the hotel to give away a better price without putting it on their brand. They can hide their brand name until after you book the property. And so they can go ahead and advertise a lower price without you knowing who they are until afterwards. An incredible idea, only possible because of modern internet-oriented technology. And
if you marry that with some human interaction, and it's a funny story on Priceline, because one of the ways I was able to use technology to my advantage was when Priceline actually had messed up one reservation that we did have. And I found an alternative just because I was friendly and got to talk to the person at the front desk who happened to work at another hotel in the Venice area. It was extraordinary. And so when you merge this technology with a sense of optimism and just culturally with just a little common sense and a little human interaction face-to-face, you come up with just this, it's almost alchemy. It's just such an incredible time.
It is definitely amazing. And then let's talk about the ride-sharing opportunities. You know, with companies like Lyft and Uber and the rest of them, I mean, you know, we're putting to work assets that have just been dormant, whether they be people assets and human resources or cars that were sitting in garages before are now being used, you know? And so it's just so much more efficient. It really, really is incredible. And we ain't seen nothing yet, as the old saying goes. I mean, the next 5 years are just going to blow all of our minds with biotech and nanotech. And
if you think about the inefficiency out there, it's when they put the price tag, I think it was $17 billion in Uber's last round. And people said, well, that sounds outrageous. But if you think about the economic inefficiency, just if you fly into where I'm in Manhattan, in JFK, you've got a line of several hundred people deep waiting for cabs. You've got a dozen cabs waiting there, and they're all flowing through one dispatcher standing centrally located. That's the same business model they had 50 years ago, literally, the exact same model. It's wildly inefficient. You're wasting millions of dollars every single day just standing there, and we suddenly just created this app where not only does that work at JFK, but you're also creating markets where you can't go outside and hail a cab. In the vast majority of this country, it's just not something that you can do. You just can't get a ride. You can't hail a cab. You can't call a cab. It's not, we don't live in that. There's probably Chicago, New York, L.A., or maybe the three cities where you can walk outside and hail a cab from the curb. Well, now all of a sudden you've opened that up to any market in the United States through this Uber Lyft type of model. It's incredible. It is
a light year advance. Let me take the pessimistic side for a moment, though, because, you know, we hear, you know, all of this bad news. We hear about the unemployment rate and the underemployment rate, which means, you know, people with college degrees and massive student loan debt now topping $1 trillion, possibly the next bubble. I'd love your comments on that. They're delivering pizza, working at Starbucks, driving an Uber car. I'll give you a great example. I was in an Uber car a few weeks ago, and, you know, I always ask the drivers, what do they do this full time? You know, what's their background? What did they do before? I'm always curious about that, as you are. And this guy said he was an investment banker. He worked on Wall Street, and here he's driving an Uber car. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, our economy is not allocating resources very well, is it? This guy's got a master's degree.
Well, I don't know. Having worked with a lot of investment bankers, he's probably adding more societal value now than he may have been before.
Fair enough. I'll agree with you there.
But I hear you on the underemployment, and you know, it's interesting. It's one of those things that's hard to define. I would never want to hire someone who didn't think they were underemployed, because you always want that sense of ambition and upward striving. But we do need a societal rethink on how we go about and what the goal is of our college education. I'm not sure how much of a value you're going to place on some of the softer sciences. I was a psych major with a film studies double major type of construct out of college. And I'm not sure that those have both served me relatively well socially and in a lot of different ways, but I'm not sure what value they themselves have in terms of what job you should be able to just be entitled to after that. I think that the real issue for the culture is whether or not your college degree is going to get you entitled to earn a living at a certain amount of money, but whether or not your hard work and your ability to add economic value is going to get paid. And as long as it's not a situation where you can't find a job, if your goal is to make money, you're unable to do that, I think we're okay. There are some jobs that simply are never going to pay that well because the capitalist system doesn't benefit them that way. And that's really where the question is. But we're giving out so many college degrees, so many more people are going to college, and they're graduating, and they're simply not coming out with skills that are necessarily commercially applicable. And it's a huge problem, a growing problem. but it's not one that I think tips over the economy, despite the fact that it's staggering sums that are at work there. There's enough money and enough sort of wherewithal that we're not going to put ourselves out of business through our own student debt.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's going to happen with that student loan debt? Because it's not dischargeable. I mean, are these kids really going to just be indentured servants? You know, they are underemployed. I mean, you know, in many of them are.
Well, it's a matter of what you want to do. Are they able to find jobs? Are they choosing to work towards their passion or towards just the commercial application? You know, you can't, the American dream is not to get paid a ton of money doing exactly anything that you know, your heart desires. The truth is you got to put some elbow grease into it and work. And so it's not indentured servitude, but if, you know, my first job out of college was I worked at Macy's and I sold men's shoes. I didn't love that job, I'll be honest with you. And so I worked hard to get out of that job to be upwardly aspirational. Now, it worked out okay for me, but it took some effort. And that was a hard adjustment. And that was something that is just part of the training society. I'm not sure what the answer is to the ugly side of this capitalist system, but you know what? It's going to take work, and it's going to take something that people are going to have to not necessarily live a lifestyle where they're going to be an NFL quarterback or live their dreams. They're going to have to do some stuff that they wouldn't necessarily dream about, with the idea that maybe it'll pay off over time as they work their way towards what their vision is for themselves, not necessarily as a 22-year-old, but someone when they're 45 or 50 years old.
You know what's fascinating to me, Jeff, and I have not reconciled this. I'm just going to admit to my audience, I think about it all the time, and I want to have a prediction for what this is going to mean, because I think it's going to be huge, and that is the area of robotics. I recently watched a 10-minute video. It was very interesting, that talked about how, you know, 45% of the jobs nowadays can be automated within the next several years. And one of the main ones, you know, we talked about Lyft and Uber, is transportation. We're on the heels of a driverless car, and that just changes the game in so many ways. They had one of those driverless semi-trucks here in Arizona, I guess, recently. You know, they demoed it in Germany, and, you know, the guy just sits there while the truck drives itself and delivers things all over the nation, you know, or all over the world, I should say. Transportation is a huge area of employment. I mean, you know, can these cab drivers retool and do something else? Or are they just going to be like permanently unemployed? I don't know.
I don't either. There isn't an answer, but that's not, it's important for the audience and for you and I to remind each other that these are not necessarily new problems. You know, the printing press put a lot of people out of work as well. And I don't say that lightly. You know, it's the cotton gin. All these inventions have displaced skilled labor, what was skilled labor in the past, and this has been a constant evolution in terms of robotics.
And it's always been positive. And, you know, computers put a lot of people out of work, but then we needed people to work on the computers. But I don't know, with these robots, they say they'll maintain themselves and fix themselves. And, you know, we're looking at it like this future. Maybe they'll just take over the world.
Well, that's the scary part. Them turning on us is actually much more scary to me than them putting us completely out of work. One thing the futurists missed is you picture sort of the George Jetson lifestyle, where basically the folks were inventing labor, or the idea that when you watch those really, really retro kind of futurist predictions from the early 60s, when, you know, housewives would sit around and dishwashers would give them so much free time they wouldn't know what to do with themselves. Well, we've managed to figure out things to do with ourselves all along. So I think as long as we keep the robots from turning on us, it should work out to our benefit.
When Elias Howe invented the sewing machine, women complained because they wouldn't have anything to do, you know. You know, how would they make themselves useful in society, right? And it seems as though they worked that out. But there's always a transition time, you know. And this doesn't happen all in one day. You know, it's not like they put up the Berlin Wall, right? You know, this is a gradual evolution. But I don't, you know, it's a pretty big deal. I mean, it's a pretty big deal. But yes, those predictions have always been there. I agree with you completely.
And ultimately, the ugly side of it, we touched on it a few different ways, but this is kind of the capitalist system. And you take, if you look at cabs, and because we've spoken about transportation, drivers in particular, and you see the way the cab industry is fighting the Ubers of the world, it's telling. and they're really expediting their own extinction by kind of demonstrating just how inefficient they really are and how antiquated that system is. And as individuals, what you have to do is be thinking ahead of that. If you're a cab driver out there and you're protesting Uber by fighting against it to protect your rate that's going to be 50% higher.
You're a dinosaur.
You got to know. The gambling adage says, if you don't know who the sucker at the table is, the sucker is you. You better know
right.
who the dinosaur, or else you're in big trouble.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, talk about the markets, if you would, for just a moment, and tell us what you think about the overall economy. We've certainly been talking about that, but maybe just some of the more specific indicators, if you want, the stock market, the real estate market, whatever you like.
Well, I think the stock market has been one that has just been feasting on the skepticism for so long, and in my game and in the book, The Clash of the Financial Pundits, we talk a lot about sort of the prophets of doom, because this has been a very easy market to criticize and badmouth for the last 5 years, since the stock market bottomed, I think it was March 9th of 2009, when the S&P 500 was 666, very demonic bottom. It's been very easy to criticize this and call it artificial, to say the Federal Reserve is printing money, that the government is in essence lifting itself up off the ground by its own ears, which is kind of impossible. And if you bet that way, you lost, and you lost big. And so there's been this bifurcation of investors, for people who have been part of this market and have been benefiting from it with some sense of distrust, because we have had two major significant crashes in the last 15 years, which is not to be ignored. And you have people who simply have sat it out from the sidelines and just bet on the sky falling over and over again. And the truth is, the sun's going to explode someday, but it's a lousy bet. And so betting on this doomsday scenario is always going to be there's no place to cash in. And so in terms of the stock market, I continue to be long stocks. I continue to be nervous about it. So many things can go wrong. But ultimately, the economy has struggled through. Corporate earnings look decent, not terrific. Balance sheets are better by far than they have been in ages. Companies literally can't figure out what to do with themselves in terms of how to put money to work. And I think if the government is sort of just the right level of screwed up right now, that they're not able to implement anything, which is kind of keeping it out of the way. But I think that's one of the bigger impediments we have to job growth in this country, because I think we're going to start insourcing some jobs that we've been outsourcing to foreign nations for years. And that's going to provide a real, real tailwind for us.
I agree.
We can get off our way.
You know where a lot of that tailwind is going to come from in manufacturing? From 3D printing, small, short-run, artisan-type manufacturing. Chris Anderson's got a great book. It's called Makers. You may have read it. And the future of 3D printing, what an awesome technology. I mean, that's just going to put a lot of people back to work in the U.S. It's going to be insourcing and onshoring labor. I agree with you there. So that's a fascinating one. Okay, so inflation or deflation in the future? What do you think?
I think we've been fighting deflation, and no one wants to use the word, because the Federal Reserve and the powers that be simply have no solution for deflation. And as a result, we're kind of in this environment where we've been printing so much money, and we really don't have either. We've ended up with this perfect tension between two horrific outcomes, one of uncontrolled inflation, which has been supposed to be manifesting itself for years now and yet hasn't gotten a foothold, simply because the economic cycle's overpowering it. I think can I choose flation between inflation and deflation?
Just flation?
It's 1.5% works for me. I just don't see the prices rising the way some of the real skeptics out there do. And I think that as long as those jobs, we've been discussing a lot of nice trends. If you're insourcing jobs, if you have a economic growth, if you have corporations with decent balance sheets, I'm not sure how you end up with a deflationary outcome. And with the information age working for our benefit, I'm not sure how you get rampant inflation when you have a nice capitalistic check and balance system in place in terms of price discovery. And so it's a pretty decent scenario. Now, is that perfect? No. Of course we're going to have outlying events, but it's we just haven't seen that inflation that we were supposed to get from all that money printing. I don't think that if the folks were wrong on inflation for the last 5 years, that you change your doomsday scenario to this deflationary environment makes me more valid. You know, again, sometimes the sky just doesn't fall. If you go outside and look up, it'll turn out the sky is still aloft.
In other words, it doesn't fall in either direction, the inflation or deflation. It's just sort of a status quo type of Phillips curve model where it's just, you know, moderate in, you know, target inflation, which the Fed always has, because deflation is something that is, it's tough to stop that. I mean, I guess they can just print money into oblivion, especially when they've got the reserve currency. But it's interesting because the government is so screwed up, and every indicator would indicate inflation, right, in terms of a monetary perspective. But technology is so amazing that it empowers the consumer, like you say, with massive amounts of price discovery literally in the palm of their hand. Okay, and that is a strong force to keep inflation in check, isn't it?
Well, and some of the ways that they've been printing money went to some of the corporations themselves, and with their balance sheets, they literally just started accumulating cash, which shows that it's harder than you think to have this uncontrolled inflation created just because people have cash. You know, it's the velocity of money, and trying to get people to spend money when they don't want to is pretty difficult, whether it's a corporation or an individual. So,
right.
You know, it,
the interesting thing is investing for it, though. See, in my eyes, you know, you got to prepare for either scenario, right? So if it's inflation, then, you know, commodities and long-term low fixed rate debt is going to be an asset to you. In my eyes, rental properties, income properties, you know, and if you have deflation, you're just going to be looking for yield at anywhere you can get it. So you got to have dividend paying stocks or cash flowing assets. All the gold bugs are going to be, you know, good luck eating your gold.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, they're going to be dying. And they have been. They've been wrong for so long. I mean, all of these doomsayers, you know, I remember Howard Ruff in the 70s, and then I had him on my show a couple of years ago. And it's like, I don't know, maybe he's finally going to be right, but I'm not seeing it yet, at least, you know.
Well, and I write about this in the book. There's a couple ways you can make a living as being a pundit. One is to make people money, which is pretty hard to do. And the other is just to scare them, because it always finds...
Right, that would be the legitimate way, make
sure,
the money.
Sure, and that's, you know, part of what's motivated me is I've enjoyed trying to keep people out of the rat traps of finance. And I like participating in it. I had a hedge fund, and I like that work, but I like working with larger audiences more. And trying to kind of explain Wall Street while still participating in it is much more gratifying to me. But what you see as part of that is you see the industry that is just selling fear, because it always sounds so smart. It always sounds like you're so in the know that this currency is going to collapse, even though the argument doesn't make a ton of sense when you get down to sort of the nuts and bolts of how your gold bricks are going to buy bread at the AMP. That never made much sense to me. But at the same time, boy, they've sold a lot of newsletters, a lot of books, and a lot of gold mining, you know, gold chip certificates, all the entire industry of the doomsday scenario. They've printed money for everyone except for their investors.
Right. Yeah, well, that's true. I would agree with you there. And I tell you, those guys seem like they're right because they're just doing the math. And this is not just about math. There's way more going on in the world than math. Okay. And so you can talk about, you know, $17 trillion this and that, and, you know, 60 to 200 trillion in entitlement obligations over the next two decades. Yeah, fine. But it's not math. This is not just about math. It's about technology, and it's about battleships and nuclear missiles and the reserve currency and, you know, throwing one's weight around. I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying it is.
Never forget that economics is a social science.
Yeah, right.
Social science. We're not doing moonshots here. We're trying to figure out how people are going to behave.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point. Well, hey, this has been a great discussion, Jeff. And give out your website. Tell people where they can find you and read your great material.
Head over to Yahoo Finance, and they're every day under Yahoo Originals. And you can find my work along with a bunch of other contributors. We've got kind of an all-star cast. And so I would encourage everyone to make it their homepage and check us out.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, Jeff Mackey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to check out HartmanMedia.com for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guests' opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice, or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.